The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Orlando, Florida is a land of fantasy. Disney princesses, the monorail, the Hogwarts Express. More recently, it's become the site of a debate over another American dream, access to higher education for all. National data shows that only 17% of students who enter community college seeking a bachelor's degree reach that goal within 6 years. A new program at the University of Central Florida helps students, especially minority students, graduate from participating community colleges and successfully transition to four-year degree programs at UCF. It's called Direct Connect to UCF, and since its launch, graduation rates have been steadily climbing among those who do reach the university system, where a whopping 71% earn a BA. Sondra Amrine wrote for Political Magazine about the program that could well become a model for the future of higher ed. And Sondra, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay, so I outlined Direct Connect. It's a pretty new program. How does it actually work? How does one transition?
Yes, well, what happens is that so much has been done in the word of mouth and marketing of this program that it's trickled down into the high school. So a lot of the students I met, they had already heard about this when they were a senior in high school. So what happens is that they were encouraged to attend the four participating community colleges, for instance, like Valencia, which is the big player in this. And so they would attend the local community college and immediately be asked if they would like to enroll in Direct Connect to University of Central Florida, or UCF, as early as their first year at the community college. And once they did that, they got put on a track, and they have a lot of advisement, which is a big piece of this. So they would be assigned different advisors, and they would be sure through the advisement and through these different track programs that they were completing prerequisites and classes that were not only work towards their AA degree or their associate's of arts degree, but also prerequisites toward a bachelor's degree or toward a major that they hoped to choose once they would transfer on to the university itself. This is a game changer in the sense that the reason why there is such a low success rate of students transferring onto the universities and then continue on to their bachelor's degree is because it's the transfer process itself across the country is such a nightmare experience for students.
Mm-hmm.
And that once they get over to the university, if they get that far, they find that because these institutions around the country don't communicate with each other, they found that they've wasted a lot of time and a lot of money accumulating credits that would do not transfer toward their major. So they have to start almost all over again. But this program eliminates that and makes it a much smoother process for students through a curriculum alignment and through a steady amount of advisement all along the way.
Mm-hmm. So the hurdles that were previously set up for students where they might have just given up and turned around, now they have someone kind of helping to guide them through.
Yes, that is a major part. Another big part are some of the things that really aren't discussed at the national level. You know, there's a big discussion about cost and tuition, which is important, but there are other things that these students are grappling with and juggling, such as some of them have families some that they're supporting, and some of them are helping out. They have single mothers that are working at home, and they're helping out with their household expenses. They have transportation issues, and so which in Central Florida is a big one. So another thing this program and partnership does, that they share facilities, the institutions share classroom space and buildings on different campuses that make it closer to the students so that they don't have to travel 1 hour, 2 hours in traffic to try to get to one of the other campuses. So there's a lot of sharing of buildings and facilities that have also made this a lot easier for students who juggle jobs and other responsibilities while they're studying.
Why did this program originate in Orlando, a place with a significant minority population and also a place with Disney World and Universal Studios, you know, big tourism economy? What made it right for Orlando and Central Florida?
This came about 10 years ago. There were two people who were crucial to this. Both of them are called visionaries. One is Sanford Shugart. He goes by Sandy Shugart. He is the president of Valencia College. Valencia College has been considered one of the top community colleges in the nation. It's very large in the Orlando area. And he began to see several trends that were colliding. One, you had the big university in town, the big regional university, UCF, becoming increasingly more selective and closed off to the communities around it, communities that were booming with minority populations and immigrant populations. Simultaneously, you have a high-tech industry that was growing in the Orlando area. So what Dr. Shugart recognized was that if something wasn't done to help his students transfer over from the community colleges over to the university, they would forever be locked out of these high-wage jobs in high-tech that were coming into the area. And instead, they may be relegated to the big game in town, which is the tourism and the hospitality industry, and those are low-wage jobs. So he got together with Dr. John Hitt, who is the president of UCF, and the two of them came up with this plan. Direct Connect went into place in 2006. And since then, they brought on several other community colleges in the region. Initially, there were four community colleges, and just recently, a fifth has been added on. So now there are five community colleges working together with UCF to create a seamless pipeline from community college level up to the university.
We're talking with Sandra Amrine. She's a freelance writer who wrote for Politico about a program connecting community college students to the University of Central Florida that's been going on for 10 years and could possibly become a national model. And you write about this kind of seminal conversation with UCF president John Hitt and the president of Valencia, Sandy Shugart, happening in a parking lot, you know, not the way a lot of education policy begins. So how do they sell this to the larger community?
Sandy Shugart, in my interview with him, he said that initially the students and their parents got it right away. They got all these components and how they would help. But there were many other critics throughout the community, including the press, he said was one of them. And they thought that it would be watering down the standards or watering down things at UCF. In other words, by letting in community college students who hadn't maybe obtained the same SAT scores and things of that nature at the freshman level. And what his counter to that was is that SAT scores and things like that are sort of predictors of how students are going to do. And what Direct Connect does is not say that all students going to Valencia and the other community colleges will get on to UCF. Instead, it's those who succeed. And so his philosophy is there is no better indicator of a student's potential than their actual performance. So rather than just relying on test scores, it's the actual performance that they do in those first 2 years at the community college level, getting ready for the university, so that will prove that they are able to perform on par with UCF's native freshmen coming in. And so by the time they're all juniors, they should be performing at somewhat equal levels. And so to do that, they also, in addition to the advisement I mentioned, there is a lot of remedial work going on as well at that freshman and junior level at the community colleges to make up for any shortfalls in the low-performing high schools that they may have come from.
You talked about several of the hurdles to a four-year education for students, but how about the cost of a state university? UCF must be significantly higher than those state or community colleges. Is there any funding available for students?
That's a great point. It's about three or four times higher. And so that's the other benefit to some of these students is that at the freshman level, rather than paying that level of a cost right out of the gate, they, by going into Valencia and some of the other community colleges or state colleges, they're paying significantly less. And they also allow them to qualify for Pell Grants. And the other thing this Direct Connect partnership did was really work hard on finding dollars for transfer students. There's not a lot out there for that. So they worked hard to do joint philanthropy. And so some of the students going into their junior year at UCF are debt-free. And they have saved one student in particular I talked to. She managed to, between all the student aid and the scholarships that she received in her Pell Grants and working on the side, she was able to save up enough money so that by her junior year, she was able to put that money toward her expected high tuition at UCF. But this partnership makes those first 2 years make the entire experience much more affordable for the students rather than if they had gone into UCF right out of the gate their freshman year.
So a number of real success stories here, some of which you share in your article for Politico, and a lot of things that cut across some of the arguments that are often made, that students who come out of bad high schools can't necessarily make it through college, even community college, that, you know, single parents, it's hard to find an education system that works for them. A lot of things that, as you write, cut to the heart of the national conversation about higher education. So is this scalable? Could this be used as a national model for education?
Yes, in fact, it already is. There are a number of other places where this type of model is being used. Arizona State University, for instance, has done this on a very large scale. They modeled part of what they're doing off of the UCF Direct Connect model. It's being used in northern states. It's being used in institutions across the country. In fact, an editor that I worked with on this story at Politico, she was the one who heard about this up in Washington, D.C. Educators up there were talking about UCF in Orlando and the Direct Connect model. So there are a lot of educators around the country looking at this, and it has already been implemented. I believe ASU, or Arizona State University, I believe their program has been in place, I want to say, if not 5, maybe 6 years. So it's a little bit younger than the Direct Connect model, but it has already started to be copied around the country.
Sandra, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Sandra Amrein, she's a Tampa-based author and freelance writer, and she wrote about the Direct Connect to UCF program, Where Dreams Come True, for Politico magazine. You'll find a link to read the article and to her blog, all at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, as we just heard, a number of students start community college with the intent to transfer into four-year degree programs. Nationally, more than 80% of them do not get that far, at least within 6 years. Word of Mouth producer Megan Tan spoke to her high school friend, Jessica Heflin, one of those who was forced to leave community college.
The goal was to go to a community college and get my associates and then transfer and ideally maybe be able to get on some financial aid then, but I never finished.
Why is that? What happened?
Within my family, we had some financial struggles. So for probably 3.5 years, both of my parents were unemployed. And that's when I pretty much took my part-time high school to college job and made a career out of it.
But you did register for classes, right?
Eventually, I was able to move into a position, which made it easier for me to take some afternoon or night classes. But once I actually moved into a manager position, it was really hard to keep going.
Do your parents, are they like huge advocates of you going back to school?
My dad, he never even finished middle school, so he doesn't talk about it.
If there was something that could have helped you, what do you think that would be?
Well, I think if there was someone there who was genuinely interested in my future and helping me figure out what it was I wanted to do, so I didn't feel like the money I am spending to go was being wasted, then I definitely would try to find a way to put the money out and finish my college degree or even just my associate's.
Jessica Heflin there, speaking to producer Megan Tan. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've been checking in on some of the less publicized rulings from the Supreme Court's 2015 term. There were three environmental regulation cases decided this session. One, Michigan versus the Environmental Protection Agency, concerned the potential impact of emissions from coal plants not on American companies or in the stock market, but on the lives and livelihoods of Americans who are exposed to coal pollutants. The Supreme Court ruled last week that a previous EPA requirement for coal plants to install mercury filtration systems was an undue and too costly burden on coal producers compared to the much lower cost of damage done to human beings. So how is that damage, the human costs, assessed? Nick Stockton wrote the article, How the EPA Puts a Price Tag on Pollution, for Wired.com. He's a science writer for Wired and is here to run through some of that assessment with us. Nick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So the SCOTUS did side with the coal plants in this decision. What did the EPA regulation require coal plants to do?
It required them to put on these scrubbers or put in like certain kind of scrubbing technology to get these mercury particles out of their smokestacks. You know, the mercury, which these little particles would get into the water streams. And, you know, the primary thing that the EPA was worried about is that it would get into fish and those pregnant mothers would eat those fish, and that would get into babies, and that affects the intelligence of babies. There's other health effects, too, but that was, I guess, the most banner threat.
So the case boiled down to a couple of crucial things. First of all, EPA, I guess, jumped the gun, making a regulation before properly assessing the human cost. Now, how is that done? How do you create the economic impact of a toxin pollutant on someone's life?
Well, you can't do it directly. It's hard to quantify in a way. There's not like a bottom line of like what a human life is worth or what an IQ point is worth. So they have to do it by evaluating other means. In this case, it was the person's lifetime earnings and what those lost IQ points would cost them over the course of their life in terms of money they would make.
Okay, so the EPA assigns a monetary value to a person's IQ. How did they even begin to do that?
So they start by looking at how much mercury is coming out of the smokestacks, and then from that, how much mercury is getting into the fish, and then from the fish into the child, and that mercury in the child's brain causes brain damage, and that results in lost IQ points, which the EPA, through a series of models, correlates to dollar value that person would have made over the course of their life.
Okay, is IQ still even used in many other instances outside of this? I mean, I'm just thinking there must be a lot of assumptions made when totaling up the dollar value for something like an IQ point.
Yeah, they point out in their report that it's not a perfect assessment. Like, there's no perfect way to do this, and there's a lot. I mean, it's 510 pages long, and a lot of it is them explaining. You know, the explanation of how they do stuff is not a huge part of it. A lot of it is like, this is what we couldn't do. This is what else we looked at.
After this assessment was completed, how much did they determine those IQ points were worth in terms of mercury exposure from coal emissions?
So what they did is they figured out the dollar value for in these five different scenarios, depending on different emissions rates, and then came up with a total amount of money to the American public of all the IQ points lost for all the children that would lose IQ points. And so from that, I did like a little simple algebra, and it's about $10,000 per IQ point.
So then how much does that add up to for estimated total damage in monetary value for affected Americans?
So per year, it's going to be anywhere from $190 to $310
million. $190 to $310 million compared to what being the estimated cost of putting mercury scrubbers on all the coal-fired plants in the country?
The cost to industry was $9.6 billion estimated in the EPA's estimations.
So is that the key, that the cost of lost IQ points and therefore livelihoods was not as great as the cost of installing scrubbing equipment?
Yes, that was what that was basically the argument of the coal industry. And that was the decision of the Supreme Court, was that yes, this did not add up. But it's important to note the EPA kind of buried the lead in their assessment. And they did a lot of other calculations for associated costs, other heavy metals, particulate matter. They catch arsenic, cadmium, lead, nickel, antimony, beryllium, cobalt, manganese, just different gases that are coming off as these scrubbers would also catch. Those savings added up, you know, well into the billions.
What surprised me, Nick, you point out that a number of coal-fired plants actually have these scrubbers already installed. What was really at issue here?
Yeah, so most coal-fired power plants have already installed this. This rule came into effect in 2003. So there's only a handful, which is about 600 coal power plants that still have to install this, and a lot of them are really old, and it would have probably been more expensive to add the thing. It probably would have been cheaper just to shut them down. And so at issue here, from what was explained to me by several economists that I spoke to, was this isn't like a huge decision in terms of environmental regulations. They aren't going to like deinstall these things, but what it does is give the coal industry and other industries more of a foothold for fighting environmental regulations in the future by saying that we have this precedent that you need to be doing these assessments beforehand.
Well, Nick, thank you for wading through that with us. We appreciate your time.
Oh, not a problem. Thank you so much for having me.
Nick Stockton is a science writer for Wired, and he wrote the article, How the EPA Puts a Price Tag on Pollution, for Wired.com. You can find a link to his article on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's hard to imagine a place where more desperate and life-changing dramas unfold on a daily basis than family court. Custody battles, abuse, divorce. And one courthouse, known to employees as the Darth Vader Building, is notorious for reflecting that misery in its architecture. Roman Mars, producer of the podcast 99% Invisible, brings us the story.
If you type the word courthouse into a Google image search, you get hundreds of results that look really similar to the U.S. Supreme Court building.
Big steps, a granite Corinthian colonnade, topped by a grand pediment. If the architecture could talk, it would say, respect me. Serious S happens here.
That's Brett Myers. He's reporting this week's show. He went to the New York County Family Court in Lower Manhattan. It's a building that looks nothing like the classic Roman and Greek-inspired architecture that most of us associate with courthouses.
There's little to equate family with the building beyond dysfunction.
If the family court could have talked before its 2006 renovation, it would have said, all who enter are doomed.
Built in 1975, this polished black cubist hulk is about as welcoming as the Death Star.
That's Eugene Patron reading from an article he wrote about his time as a paralegal in the building. He sums up the most common argument about the original design.
The New York County Family Court at 60 Lafayette Street is infamous in architecture circles as an example of form giving not a damn about function.
And that's an easy argument to make.
Absolutely. It filled me with rage the first time I saw this building back in the late 90s. The design just seemed so wrong for a family courthouse. It was like hiring Dick Cheney to be the nanny for your kids.
It was brutalist. Think repetitive angles and thick, heavy forms and lots of concrete. It's a pretty polarizing style, which I actually kind of like.
And before the 2006 remodel, it was possible to appreciate this building, but from afar. Up close was a different story. The shiny black granite panels that covered the whole thing were falling off and threatening to kill people on the ground. It was a looming and menacing building. Even the entrance was scary. There were these huge pylons offset at 45-degree angles, so that when you entered the building, you couldn't actually see what it was you were walking into. It was like stepping into a black hole.
Definitely very bleak and very, oh my God, what is this, a black building, you know? Is this a courthouse?
Miriam Hernandez works there as an interpreter-translator.
It didn't really have the feeling of humanity or humane, you know? It didn't really have that.
What kind of stuff happens inside?
Oh my God, the question should be, what doesn't happen? What doesn't happen? I mean, it's like you could write maybe a forever book about what takes place inside, you know?
And that forever book wouldn't be a light read. It would have chapters about custody battles and divorces and abuse, children going into family court and their fates being decided behind those doors. If anything, you would hope that the architecture would inspire trust, not fear, and maybe even convey a little bit of warmth. But instead, court employees refer to it as the Darth Vader Building.
Luke, your mother and I are getting a divorce.
Pardon me, Lord. The question is, was the form of the New York County Family Courthouse completely antithetical to its function? I met a guy who's got a really interesting theory about this.
This guy goes by the name Lofter One.
My Clark Kent is basically I do freelance research.
By day, he's a writer-researcher for a real estate blog, but his secret identity is Lofter1. It's the handle he uses when contributing to Wired New York, this hugely popular website about all things New York City. The community section is basically a forum for urban design geeks, and Lofter1 is one of the biggest geeks on the site.
So, how many posts have you posted since June?
Way too many for a sane person. About, a couple thousand. I'm not sure. No, it's like 28,000, something like that.
28,131 posts.
That's as of when? Because you didn't check this morning, did you? I've added a few.
You've added a few today?
Yeah. I go on there almost every day.
In fact, he averages almost 13 posts per day. And most are related to architecture and urban planning. One of his first posts was about the remodel of the building we're talking about, the family courthouse, the building we're standing in front of.
That right. Old place, I felt like I was kneeling down and crawling through a teeny little hole in a cave.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what the hell. There's a bear, there were bats, right. There was something right. On the other side.
What happened inside was not going to be good. They should have put, abandon hope, all ye who enter here. Because that's what the message it was sending.
And Lofter 1 argues that that message had a timestamp. That old, black, shiny Death Star of a building reflected the New York of the times, the New York back in the 70s when it was built.
Watergate, financial distress, social divide. It all makes total sense.
Total sense that this building looked the way it did. And this argument gains even more weight when you consider a 1977 story by famed New York Times reporter Laurie Johnston. The article profiles users of the court in what is essentially a critique of the system. She interviews people who spend days shuffling from one waiting room to another, and their critiques of the bureaucracy go hand in hand with critiques of the architecture.
Here's a quote from the 1977 article. It seems like a maze, this place, or worse. It seems like it's run like a prison, with uniforms all over. Maybe it's meant to discourage you from going ahead.
It's like, oh, you want form to meet function? This is how this court functions. This is what this court does. It sucks people in and spits them out, and there's no feeling. It doesn't solve the problems.
Now, of course, the courthouse has been remodeled, and it's warmer and friendlier, and it reflects a city that's friendlier and more functional.
The black facade is all gone. It's kind of a light gray now. And the entrance is all opened up. It even has kind of an awning.
That doesn't look imposing or unfriendly at all.
And there's no more threat that those black granite panels are going to fall off the side of the building and kill people.
And oh yeah, it's also kind of boring.
The remodel is definitely a little boring, and it's not a building I want to talk to my friends about. But that original building angered me, and it was something I talked to my friends about. It was dark and interesting.
And now Brett kind of misses the old building.
But I also know that I'm privileged because I don't have to interact with it, because I don't have to work there, and I'm not a kid who has to walk into family court. For them, this milky, bland remodel is a definite improvement.
And probably a sacrifice worth making. Come on, it's for kids, man.
And that story came to us from Roman Mars, producer of the podcast 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You are locked in a dark room with a dozen strangers and one hungry zombie. Maybe you're all in an underground tunnel and quickly running out of oxygen. All the doors are locked and you're running out of time. You may feel like you're trapped inside of a video game, but it's real life and you paid for it. Welcome to the escape room experience. They're popping up from LA to Sydney and, as we'll soon hear, in New Hampshire. Television viewers can watch this game to survive beginning this month on the Science Channel's Race to Escape. Rick Paulus wrote about the new series and the rise of escape rooms for Pacific Standard Magazine. And Rick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia.
What are escape room games and how did they start?
Well, it kind of runs the gamut right now. There's escape room games can be anything that a handful of people enter some room that has been made that are just filled with puzzles that the contestants usually have to work together, and they just have to go through puzzle by puzzle in order to get out. And sometimes, as you mentioned, there's usually a time limit associated with them. Usually it's about an hour or so. And sometimes it's just a ticking clock in the corner of the room, and other times it's a zombie that slowly gets their chain increasingly lengthened as they get closer and closer to the contestants.
You write that they started popping up around 2006 and 2007. What do you think was behind that?
Yeah, it's tough to point exactly to who sort of gets the claim as being like the one innovator behind it. There was definitely an escape room out in Silicon Valley, and there were some out in, I believe, China. And as far as why it happened, everyone's kind of, part of my central thesis was that people were going to say that it was because of internet usage and people looking for more of a real life thing, but no one really agreed with that. And so it was more people were just saying, you know, this is like the next step of entertainment. You have Blu-ray and you have like high definition and you have 3D. And so the next step in that evolution is just what makes things more real. And there's nothing more real than real life.
Yeah, I also think of adventure games, you know, Tough Mudder, you know, the kind of extreme situations that people put themselves in to test their, I guess, survival instincts.
Yeah, there's definitely some through lines from that, too.
Well, they're rapidly becoming a trend and have hit the mainstream with a new series coming up on the Science Channel, which surprised me. I mean, it sounds like one of those extreme survivalist shows that you might see on TLC. Why the Science Channel?
Well, one of the most interesting things about this was when I was speaking to the creator of that show, he was very enthusiastic about not necessarily the escape room aspect of it as much as the psychological interactions between the contestants. Sort of what the hook of that show is that instead of going into a room with your friends, you've gone in with three total. So two strangers, you and two strangers. And kind of watching and examining how those strangers interact with one another in order to form teams and to kind of see who becomes the leader and who becomes the followers and that type of thing. Where the game came from for him was during the New York blackout of the early 2000s, I forget exactly the year, and kind of how people were thrust into this environment where they were forced to take on roles that they didn't always necessarily have in their sort of everyday, day-to-day life. And so I think that for him, the most interesting thing, and I'm sure for the viewers it will be too, is just the like seeing somebody who talks sort of brashly and that, you know, I can kind of lead everyone, don't worry about it, I'll get in there and do fine. And then once the timer starts ticking down and the money starts decreasing as far as what you could win, and they kind of, you know, maybe all of a sudden aren't just the leaders that they thought they were.
Well, Rick, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Rick Paulus writes the Sociological Imagination column for Pacific Standard, and we found his article, The Rise of Escape Room Games, there. You can find a link to read his article on escape rooms at wordofmouthradio.org. As we just heard, the escape room trend is spreading all over the globe, including New Hampshire. And this week, New Hampshire's very first escape room is opening in Manchester. Pamela and Andrew Preventure are owners of the Granite State Escape, which I guess has its open house today, right?
It does, between 4 and 8 p.m.
Not to find a point on it. Well, Pamela and Andrew, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having us.
Well, Pamela, I understand that you left a job in the mortgage industry. Did I get that right?
I did. I was in the mortgage industry for about 6 years.
All right. And so you had this bold vision to start an escape room.
You know, I did one out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania with some friends. And we were looking for something unique to do together out there. And we looked at the internet. We found this and we checked it out. And I walked in and said, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. So I figured New Hampshire really needed something like this, something that's unique and fun to do. So we decided to build one here. I came home, I talked to Andrew about it, and he was fully on board.
So how do you even begin to design this? I mean, what's the scenario that you created for it?
Andrew, I'm going to defer this one to you.
I'd say that, you know, Pam's very creative, and I think that when she got back from Pittsburgh and kind of wanted to adapt her own idea and kind of create her own version of it. And, you know, we first kind of sat down and thought about what are rooms that we think would be interesting. So the first one that popped to our mind was a jail cell, obviously. I think when people, you know, I think people struggle to understand this concept sometimes just because it's so new. and we get, you know, some very, you know, crazy things that people might, you know, think these are. And when we really thought about what's something that kind of really seals into someone's brain, and a jail cell is one of the ones that definitely locks onto someone.
You want to escape.
Absolutely. Exactly. Absolutely. So we knew the jail cell was going to be one aspect. And for the other room, we wanted to do something that kind of had like a mystery involved to it. Personally, we both love doing the murder mysteries or the dinner theater and something like that. And we feel that can kind of appeal to a larger group and kind of help bring them into the fold. So Pam had a great idea for a funeral parlor, and we've been able to acquire a actual gorgeous
casket. Brand new, I promise.
Brand new casket. And it looks phenomenal. The rooms are really coming together nice, and it's just been a process of kind of working backwards and finding out how we can, you know, make a really good, authentic experience for someone.
Well, and I guess you'd have to keep changing it, right? If you have people coming back, or?
Yes. So the actual rooms are going to stay the way they are for the duration of that room. So instead of redesigning the room, because it's a significant amount of effort and time that goes into designing these, instead we decided that we'll come up with completely new spaces. So every 6 months or so, we're going to introduce a new room. So it's going to be a completely different theme, something completely new for everybody. And it's more fun for us. It gives us something new to work towards.
All right. So from what I understand about the escape room phenomenon is there are all sorts of sort of puzzles inside of the room that people, sometimes strangers, sometimes, you know, a party or a corporate gathering, would get thrust into together. And then they have to figure things out. Are they doing this by, I don't know, climbing walls or just doing puzzles?
So there's a bunch of different ways that you can solve these puzzles. We have a variety of different types of puzzles as well. So the key is to try to connect with as many people as possible. So just to give an example, one of ours is the jail cell. So you start actually locked in the jail cell. So you need to use things around you. Maybe maybe you're using something from the bedding, or maybe there's a Bible and you're looking through it, and you have to find different clues, keys to help you escape the jail cell. Once you're out of that, you're actually in the detective's office. So now you have to use everything in that in that area to get out of that space as well. So it's about putting things into a series. It's about having a variety of different ways to really reach people. And it's interesting just to see how they come up with their own ways to solve it. It's really interesting.
There's no one right way.
There is definitely a way to do it, but you don't necessarily have to do it in that particular series. So, you know, I mean, we have clues all over the place, and they might not connect with what's right in front of you. So it's all about misdirection. It's all about challenging people, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, what's your role? How do you kind of supervise this? Are you in the room with them?
Pamela's the game master. That's what I mean. All these rooms have a camera system inside them. So the staff at Granite State Escape is able to watch these people inside. In case someone's really struggling or having a difficult time, we're able to kind of give them a clue. And, you know, we want people to have a good experience.
Oh, you could be like the people in the Hunger Games that float
exactly.
down those little sort of...
That's exactly correct, yeah. So we'll be able to kind of watch people and help them out along the way. So I think that really our real role is a facilitator. We are the ones who lock the room. Or the ones who kind of are watching just to see that everything's flowing correctly. And then if someone does have questions or something, we're a person that they can, you know, reach out to. But a lot of folks generally like to go in there and just be in there for as long as it takes, 60 minutes, and they try to do what they can get done. And they don't really want a clue or a hint, and we can respect that.
Or on the flip side, they're very competitive, and they'd like to get out of there as quickly as they can. You know, so we've implemented a leaderboard for the teams who are able to escape the fastest. Because I know for me personally, that would be my number one goal going in, not just solving it, but trying to do it as quickly as possible.
Well, I'm thinking and hearing you guys, entertainment venue, locked room. How has it been to open this, you know, with fire regulations and codes and all of that kind of stuff in Manchester?
That's actually a very interesting question, given my conversations this morning. But it has been a process for sure. The biggest struggle for us is just trying to educate people as to what this is. And that includes the city. You know, I mean, they've been wonderful once they understand the concept and they really get a grasp of what we're trying to do. But it's understandable that they might freak out in the beginning when we say we're locking people in a room.
Yeah, no, and they've been great to work with. And, you know, from there, they don't necessarily have codes that fall in line with something like this. So I think it's them trying to find the right place where it fits, and fire making sure that we're meeting all the safety precautions that they want to see happen in order for it to happen. But from our perspective too, we think it's kind of funny, and in some ways we have more kind of protection going on in this room than almost anywhere you'd go.
Right.
We have someone who's monitoring you the full time. We have, safety codes for people if they ever wanted to get out. And we know they're only going to be in there for 60 minutes. So it's in a weird way, we almost feel like you're safer in there than you are in most locked places.
In the panic room.
That's
exactly.
Right, yeah.
Well, there's a series coming up on Science Channel. I know this has been featured in other television programs, and they're being built all over the country. Where do you think this draws from? Where is this trend coming from? Escape-based puzzles, video games, CSI shows, James Bond wannabes. What's going on here?
We think it's a combination of everything. We're in the digital age, and everybody is constantly inundated with television, with video games, and things get very real. Just video games and looking at the effects, and you almost feel like you're there, but you're not. We're really giving an opportunity for people to actually interact and be in this situation, so they can actually be there with their group of friends, with their family, with their coworkers, and they can have a hands-on experience. And I think that that is what is really attracting everybody to it.
Yeah, I think that for so long as a society with, video games becoming, high def and so immersive, that for a while we were looking for something outside of reality to enjoy, something in a video or a movie, and all those graphics and everything have gotten so high and great that I almost feel like the next frontier is just coming back to reality again. Mm-hmm. And, for someone to be able to live a video game in real life, and with your friends, and interact directly, and you only have 60 minutes, and you have to multitask, and you have to work with people, and sometimes that means working with strangers. So I think that it adds, just a reality aspect to give you an experience that is outside of normal daily life, but not, through the lens of a screen or something like that.
And nobody gets hurt.
And nobody gets hurt. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Pamela and Andrew, best of luck to you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pamela and Andrew Preventure, owners of Granite State Escape, which is having an open house today in Manchester. And you'll find much more about the business at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast and never miss an episode. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, write a review or pass it along or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.